Leaders are all around us at all times and in every area of our lives. They motivate. They risk the first step. But what motivates a leader? In our Central Texas Leadership Series, KWBU has invited local leaders to talk with people they know who guide and inspire to find out what makes them tick. In this episode, Dr. David Owalalu, Global Affairs Analyst, author, and Professor of Government at McLennan Community College. Hosting the conversation is attorney David Schleicher. This conversation was recorded June 21st, 2016, in the KWBU studio.
Welcome to KWBU's Central Texas Leadership Series. I'm David Schleicher, talking today with Dr. David Owalalu, Global Affairs Analyst, Professor of Government at McLennan Community College, and author of More Than a Handshake, The Ambiguous Foreign Policy of the United States Toward the Muslim World. How are you, David?
Good. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you. You also may know David Owalalu, who also goes by David O., for those who have trouble with the last name, as a member of the Waco Tribune Herald Board of Contributors and as a Huffington Post columnist. David, first tell us a little about what you do at MCC.
Well, I teach government. I teach both the federal and state, and I also support MCC's effort with different high schools. I teach the dual credit courses for seniors who are planning on moving into college. So far, that's the concentration of my courses based on the federal and state governments.
Give us a 5-minute summary of how a Muslim from Morocco ends up teaching community college in Waco, Texas.
Wow. Yes, I was born in Morocco. I lived there for almost 17 years. After my mother passed away, I decided to leave the country. I did know that I was going to go to some unknown world, and the idea of me returning to Morocco was not in the back of my mind. So I end up in America.
All right.
I've been here for almost 27 years.
And how did you get to the Central Texas area?
Being in Central Texas came through the military. I was stationed at Fort Hood. I was part of the MI unit, 312th MI unit. At First CAF in Fort Hood. And when I left the military in 2001, July, I remember, I was working on completing my master's degree, and I used to have a roommate who used to live in Waco. I said, yeah, why don't you just come and, you know, stay with me here? And that's how I was exposed to Waco. I liked it since then, and I completed my master's degree during that time frame. And after that, I left to Washington.
And when you say working for MI in the Army, you're referring to military intelligence?
That is correct. We always refer to it as MI.
And while you were still kept your ties to Waco, but working out of D.C., can you give us an idea of what you did?
My work in Washington, D.C. was in support of the United States government projects around the world. Those are mainly pertaining to policy, diplomacy, and even some tactical aspects to it. So even though I moved back to Waco in 2005, I was still maintaining my employment in Washington, D.C. till about 2013. And that's when I said, okay, I've been long enough supporting the government. Maybe it's time to embark on a different career. And while taking a trip to Paris to go see my family, I received an email from MCC. They said we would be interested in interviewing you for a teaching position, and I responded back, and I said, okay, I'll get back to you as soon as I get back to the state, and we set the date. And I came back, I met with the Professor Salazar, I remember, and I was introduced to the division chair, Professor Montemayor, and I was hired. So the next fall I started teaching, in 2014, I started teaching the government classes.
And then you've also taught some lifelong learning classes for Baylor.
That is correct. I was reached by Baylor, the Lifelong Learning Program Director, Bob Ann Center. She interviewed me to the point I was like, wow, she's taking too many notes. I said, are you part of the government? Because I was surprised a little bit, but she wanted to know the details of what I came from and how I ended up in Waco and so forth. And I agreed to teach there, or not teach, basically, it's providing lectures. And why I decided that is because I wanted to share my knowledge with the community.
And what do you have one coming up in the fall for Baylor?
That is correct. There is one coming up, and we're going to be addressing the geopolitics of a nuclear Iran program.
That sounds like it may overlap with the title of your next book.
Well, I'm going to be working on, as far as the title, I didn't definitely decide on which title I'm going to be using for my second book. I am in process right now of writing the book, and once I finish the manuscript, I'll sit down and think about which title will be more appropriate for the type of manuscript I'm going to be doing.
And as someone who grew up in a Muslim culture and has also worked on the ground overseas in support of the U.S. government, what do you think is the biggest error that foreign policymakers in the U.S. Make in relation to the Middle East?
Well, being born in Morocco, I was exposed to, of course, the Islamic culture and traditions and so forth. At the same time, half of my family were Christians, some of them Protestants. So I grew up in that environment where we learned one thing at early age is to have respect for differences no matter what. So my understanding in Morocco, the culture and the way I was raised up, came to serve me well when I started supporting the United States government project. And the one thing I noticed about U.S. Officials representing the United States overseas is they don't have an in-depth understanding of the culture. This is not about just reading a book and calling yourself an expert. It's a matter of understanding the ins and outs of what the culture is all about. It's understanding what the religion stands for, and having that in-depth will help you and facilitate the negotiations between the U.S. and whatever country we were dealing with. And that's one thing I noticed, that some officials, they didn't have that in-depth understanding of what the culture stands for. And to my benefit, that's why I was hired to assist those officials with acquiring a better understanding during negotiations.
Well, let's get to one of the very basic disputes in the Middle East, that between the Shia and the Sunni cultures. Give us, for those that don't have any background in that, give us an idea of what, how the two groups split off and what the battle is over today.
Well, in a nutshell, the conflict goes back some thousand years ago. It goes way back to the era of Prophet Muhammad, when one of his cousins was supposed to be the head of the Islamic Ummah, and he was assassinated. And when he was assassinated, because the whole idea was about that Angel Gabriel made a mistake in delivering the prophecy letter to Prophet Muhammad. It wasn't supposed to be for the Prophet Muhammad. And the Sunnis, on the other hand, they didn't want to buy that argument. It's kind of like, that's nonsense. The Shia, on the other hand, they didn't like the fact that one of the Prophet Muhammad's cousin, Ali, was assassinated, and that just was the initial start of the conflict that still on. As a matter of fact, it is more vividly relevant today than it was, let's say, 50 years ago or so, and that's where it started. So the conflict itself is an old one.
And where do some of the major players in the Middle East line up on that Shia versus Sunni divide?
Well, your best example to that will be Saudi Arabia versus Iran. And now it's becoming more prevalent, not only because of the Iran's nuclear program, but also because the meddling of Iran within the internal affair on certain countries like Bahrain, which Bahrain has majority Shia. Saudi Arabia is concerned because in the southeast part of the kingdom, they are majority Shiites live there. So the concern within the Sunni countries is they fear that it might be a rebellion from the Shiites. Add to that, the quagmire in Yemen, the sectarian violence in Iraq, the tensions in Lebanon, all those countries have presence of Shiites within their communities. And that becomes now the fight over ideology, Shiites versus Sunnis. The argument to those who say, well, the Shia is going to dominate the Muslim world, that's nonsense, because you got 170 million Shiites in a population of 1.6 billion. So mathematically, it's not feasible.
For those who are just joining us, this is KWBU's Central Texas Leadership Series. I'm David Schleicher, talking today with Dr. David Wallaloo, a global affairs analyst, professor of government at MCC, author of More Than a Handshake, The Ambiguous Foreign Policy of the United States Toward the Muslim World. You also may have read his columns on the Huffington Post or in the Waco Tribune Herald. And we were just talking about the Shia versus Sunni divide. Say 500 or 600 years ago, we had Catholics and Protestants, even more recently in Ireland, killing each other over their differences. What do you see as the potential for the Shia and the Sunni to get past these differences and work together?
Usually I'm an optimistic person, but I just don't see that issue resolving itself in the near future. It's going to take generations before that issue settles. And why? Because there are certain political agendas behind the conflict. Some on both parties, on the Shiites and the Sunni parts, they want the conflict to go on because that provides them the platform on which to push their political agenda forward. Because when you look at the difference between Sunnis and Shiites, when it comes down to practices, there are basically none. There are certain minor things here and there. It's like in Protestants and Catholics, they have few minor things. But as far as the core beliefs, they are the same. It's just a matter of now politics gets in the middle of the conflict, and it's what's driving that animosity between the two sects in their religion.
We've been through the Arab Spring. Maybe now we're in the Arab winter. What do you see as the prospects for democracy taking root in the Middle East?
Well, as I mentioned in my book, one of the mistakes U.S. foreign policy establishment made was the assumption that Arab Spring is about democracy. Arab Spring was never about democracy because one particular concept, the separation between church and state, church being a mosque in this case and state being the government, does not exist in the Muslim world. Because the thinking within the Muslim world is that the government and religion goes hand in hand. So Arab Spring was never about democracy. So it was a misconception for us in the West to think that it's what it was all about. And what made even that more prevalent is you look at the case of Egypt when there was a military coup and the United States turns a blind eye on it. And that just raised some questions within other Muslim countries and other parts of the world that, okay, why the United States is not standing for what's right? We don't turn our eyes on military coups. We don't provide aid. And that just triggers some questions within, is democracy real? Is it true or is it just a shallow thing? But within the Muslim world, the last thing was to think about democracy because people were thinking about how can I have an economic opportunities? How can I better my life? How can I better the life of my family? How can I have a voice within the government? The problem that the Muslim world finds itself after the Arab Spring, mainly the countries where the Arab Spring erupted, is that there were no democratic infrastructures because they have never been once there before. And that was the problem. So all of a sudden, when you look at the tyrants being removed, the country found itself, they didn't know what to do. And that turned into animosity, into anger. And yes, the right term for using winter rather than Arab Spring, it's the perfect description for it.
Let's bring it to a local level. You've been on several interfaith panels in Waco. You've spoken to classes at Baylor about Islam. What do you experience and what do you perceive about the relationship locally between Christians and Arabs and Christians and Muslims, Jews and Christians, Jews and Muslims? What have you seen locally?
Well, from my personal experience, I really felt welcome in any place I went. I was invited the first time to a Baptist church to give a presentation. I never thought that they would invite a Muslim, and yet when I went there, they welcomed me with open arms. They were very sincere. They were very warm. And I didn't feel it. I mean, I felt like part of the community. And also because I agreed to do the presentation because I wanted to help further that understanding about a different culture. Because there was always that perception that if we don't know something, we tend to be fear of it. So I wanted to be that bridge. Let me tell you what that particular culture or what that particular religion is all about. Then you can make your own, you reach your own conclusions. So far in the community, I feel very, very welcome, very respected, because, you know, I just explain based on what I know, and we exchange ideas, because I am not there to judge them, and I notice they are not there to judge me either.
And I guess as part of that interfaith outreach, you were married to a Christian from Canada, is that right?
That is correct. My wife, Michelle, is a Canadian, and she's a Christian. And the bad part is she doesn't speak French, so we can't communicate in French. So so she is from the English-speaking part of Canada, in Toronto. And yes, even with my own family, we do have that mutual respect. My religion is no better than hers, and hers is no better than mine. Michelle can go both ways. She can go to the church and she can go to the mosque with me whenever she feels like it. I do the same. When I have time, I will go to the church. And yes, I am a Muslim. She is Christian. And we not impose my religion on her. She would not impose her on mine. Same with the kids. We just let them learn about religions. Let them be. Let them make their own conclusion. And that's what I believe in.
Well, and this is being recorded during Ramadan, and a lot of people may not be familiar with Ramadan. Can you give us an overview of what Ramadan is, and then talk about some of the things that you do as part of that, how that affects your daily routine?
Okay. Well, Ramadan is one of the five pillars of Islam. It is required by those who can perform it. There's also the other side of Ramadan for those who say that the religion is very ascetic, and Ramadan demonstrate that. I will have to disagree with them, because there are cases where an elderly cannot fast. He or she is authorized. A lady who just gave birth, she cannot fast. She is authorized. It's somebody who's traveling. He or she is authorized to fast. So there's always that alternatives within Ramadan itself. Personally, I like to do Ramadan. It's because not only I've been doing it since I was, 15, 16 years old, but I found it healthy for me. Even in Ramadan, fasting and not drinking, I still can go exercise in the afternoon, and I just feel very, very comfortable doing it. I always think of Ramadan like a car. Think of it this way. For a car, we have to change oil at some point. Well, same with our bodies. We have to give our bodies a rest at some point during the year. And this is no different than in Christianity with the Lent, and there's no different with the Jewish traditions as well. So for us, Ramadan is about 29 to 30 days. Every year it rotates by 11 days. So probably within 8 years from now or 9 years, Ramadan will be in the fall. We'll have shorter days. Now, because it's summer, we have to fast till about 8:35. And speaking of Ramadan, before I forget, for the community to know, we're going to be hosting an iftar or dinner, if you will, this coming Saturday on the 25th. And we welcome everybody from the community, whoever would like to attend.
And that's June?
That's June 25th.
25th, just in case.
We will meet at 7 o'clock at the Islamic Center of Waco.
So now as part of Ramadan, you get up at like 4 in the morning to eat?
I usually get up at 4:30 because you have to stop eating at dawn. I usually eat an apple and a glass of water or a glass of milk and a little bit of peanut butter. I don't eat much, and because your body adjusted to that. Then we eat when the sun goes down. We break fast. Usually, tradition, you break fast with either water or a date. Then you eat a meal. In some traditions within the Muslim world, they'll eat another meal at 12 o'clock, midnight. I usually don't. I skip all that. I just have one meal at sundown. And at 4:30 in the morning, I'll get up and have an apple or yogurt or something like that.
For those who are just joining us, this is KWBU's Central Texas Leadership Series. I'm David Schleicher, talking today with Dr. David Walaloo. He's a global affairs analyst, a professor of government at McLennan Community College. He's also author of More Than a Handshake, The Ambiguous Foreign Policy of the United States Toward the Muslim World. You also may read his columns on the Huffington Post or in the Waco Tribune Herald, and find out more about him at www.morethanahandshake.com. We were talking about Ramadan and it being one of the five pillars of Islam. You didn't know I was going to quiz you today, but tell us what the other four pillars are.
The other four as the confirmation of the oneness of God, and that the Prophet Muhammad is the last of the messenger. The second one is the prayer, the performance of the daily prayers. The third one is the giving of alms or charity. The one thing I need to clarify about this charity is not a tax. There's no tax in Islam. That's charity for the needy. The fourth one is the pilgrimage, when you go to Mecca once in your lifetime. And the fifth is the fasting of Ramadan. They are not in order. It doesn't matter which order they are. It just each pillar serves as a specific or particular objective. And those are the five pillars of Islam.
And your next book about a nuclear Iran, what's your view of the treaty that the U.S. has entered into with Iran? Is that going likely to work?
Well, there are some clauses into the treaty that are classified, I believe, based on what I read and search and the individuals that I talked to. it will be hard to tell at this point, the reason being because the deal itself goes for an extension of 15 years. We don't know what's going to happen after 15 years. And that's where the challenge is we have to have mechanisms by which we can track the activities of the Iranian nuclear program and whether it will be an enrichment of the uranium again or fissile material or an importation of other devices that will be used into the nuclear. So it's a very, very challenging. So far, we do have mechanisms in place that will monitor the program at least for the next 10 years or 15. But there's all you never know, because you look at India and Pakistan, India in 1974 and Pakistan in 1990, there were some mechanisms there, but we did not know till they conducted the nuclear test in underground. So we were surprised with that.
And based on your study of the Middle East and reading of newspapers from that area, what do you see coming up from the next generation in Iran? Are they looking for a better relationship with the U.S., or is it a matter of wanting to maintain the hostilities we've had in the past?
Actually, there is a misconception in the West that Iranians are hostile to the West. I'll have to disagree with that. The reason being because when you look at Iran, you have to divide it into two, the leadership, the theocracy, and the Iranian people. Iranian people wants to integrate into the international community. They want to be part of the developments. They want to have access to technology. They want to have access to a higher education, to sciences, and so forth. They want to be part of the international community. The theocracy, on the other hand, they want to maintain power. So the way they can do that, it's still depending on the principles of the so-called the Islamic Revolution of 1979, because it was a sale. If you can promote the West or America as the Satan and so forth, you can rally the masses around it. But the youth in Iran, they don't buy it. Even with the nuclear program, majority of the Iranian population, they were in support of the lifting of sanctions and giving up the nuclear program. The hardliners, the ones in power, they didn't want that. What they did, they went ahead and altered the surveys. Based on my research, what I found, they altered the surveys to promote a unity, to say to the world, look, we are united on this front. We are not going to give up our nuclear program. But the majority of the youth, they don't want it. They say, give up the program. In return, we're going to have the lifting of sanctions. I mean, you'll be surprised to find out how many young Iranians know about America. They know about baseball. They know about Elvis Presley. They know about all the pop cultures we have. We just don't hear much about that on the media.
Well, here's a question that may not have a short or easy answer. What to do about a problem like ISIS? Do we send in, 50,000 more troops? Do we ignore them? Seems like diplomacy is not working in Syria. What do we do?
Yes, it's not an easy question, and given the time frame to provide an answer for, I strongly believe that the Arab countries, Muslim countries, needs to contribute to the force. Why not let the Muslim countries, send their own troops? Why the United States has to be in front, carrying the burden, not a treasury and blood. let the Muslim countries send their own troops, let them fight ISIS, because it's more a threat to them than it is to us.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem in itself is, for us at least, we don't understand who's who. And that stems back from lack of understanding the culture. I'm sure you've been a read, and I did write an article about how, the, for example, the Pentagon and CIA, both groups are fighting each other.
Fighting each other.
Because nobody knows who's who. And that's one of the issues we don't know. It's also because we don't have footprints on the ground. You can't depend on satellites for everything mm-hmm. when it comes down to intelligence matters. So the problem with ISIS is because the propaganda using Islam on the forefront, and what's happened with the Muslim world is anything that you attach the word Islam to it will be unquestionable.
Mm-hmm.
So, which means, in my opinion, it is time for the Muslim world to start question the religion itself. So they need to send in their own troops to solve
okay.
these issues.
You ever keep track of how many countries you've visited?
I sort of. It was about, 28 countries, something like that. That was my work when I was in Washington was mainly overseas, so we travel a lot. That's one of the reasons why it was also an opportunity for me to move up to a different career path. It, because my kids were growing and I'm not around. I used to only live about 3 months out of a year.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, and we've got about a minute and a half left. Why don't you tell us one thing that gives us some hope that these issues will be resolved?
Well, eventually, because the upcoming generations, at least the Muslims that were born and raised here, they have a different perspective. They have a different point of view. And I've always believed, and immigrants or not, when you live in America, you got to embrace the American values. That's part of who we are. You can be an American by name, and yet you live a different life from that culture. That just doesn't work that way. The younger generations will eventually understand very well how to implement their tradition and so forth, but at the same time embrace American values and move our country forward.
Okay, and you think social media is playing a role in that?
A big deal. I mean, that's part of our daily life now. You can't have any communication or conversation with the rest of the world. Just think about it. When something happens, we put it on Facebook. It's all over the world in a matter of time. So media plays a positive role into this.
This has been KWBU Central Texas Leadership Series, an interview with David Wallaloo. He is a professor of government at MCC, author of More Than a Handshake, The Ambiguous Foreign Policy of the United States Toward the Muslim World. You can find out more about him at his website, www.morethanahandshake.com. And you can also read his editorials in the Waco Tribune Herald or on the Huffington Post. I'm David Schleicher. Thank you, Dr. O, David Wallaloo, for being with us today.
My pleasure. It's been a treat. Thank you very much.
This program was recorded June 21st, 2016, in the KWBU studio.